Good evening. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm a trustee of this wonderful library, and it's great to welcome all of you on this beautiful spring night. And it's such a pleasure for me to introduce library member and wonderful author Susan Nagel. I am honored to be introducing today's author. She will be telling you about her fascinating, highly detailed, and engrossing book, Marie Therese, Child of Terror. So let me tell you about Susan Nagel. She is familiar to all of us as the author of another remarkable, meticulously researched book, The Mistress of the Elgin Marbles. Ms. Nagel has also written for the stage, the screen, scholarly journals, the Gannett newspapers chain, and Town and Country. She is a professor of the humanities at Marymount College. Susan Nagel is a keen historical investigator, a real Nancy Drew of the mysteries of the Bourbon family, an 18th century European royalty. This page-turning biography brings to vibrant life the remarkable Marie Therese and the Age of Revolution. And now let us welcome Susan Nagel.
Thank you so much, and I'm very proud to be a member of the New York Society Library. I hope I'm not offending anybody, but I would like to warn you that we are going to break a lot of rules of politeness tonight. We're going to talk about sex, politics, and religion. I apologize in advance. And I actually need the slide remote. I didn't want anyone to trip over that. A bit louder? Is that better? Okay. Well, so let's first begin with a look at Salic law. Salic law was a medieval law that had been implemented to preclude women from ascending the thrones of Europe. In the early 18th century, Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI, who had no sons, became determined to place his own daughter, Maria Theresa, on the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There we have Maria Theresa. He made it clear that he was not open to negotiation, as he bribed and bullied his own cousins and other German princes to accept his decree, the Pragmatic Sanction. Maria Theresa became Empress of Austria, but was not allowed the title of Holy Roman Empress. Throughout her reign, she was constantly challenged by men for her throne. It was not until the birth of her own son, Joseph, that things quieted down somewhat, and other leaders accepted her as ruler of the sprawling Austrian Empire. Maria Theresa decided that after centuries of hostilities, she would ally Austria with France against England. The Seven Years' War, or as we in the United States call it, the French and Indian Wars, from 1756 to 1763, brought Austria and France together as tenuous collaborators. And when the Franco-Austrian experiment did not turn out happily for their side, Empress Maria Theresa of Austria served up 14-year-old Maria Antonia as a wife for the Dauphin of France. The current king, Louis XV, was the young Dauphin's grandfather and, as his most Christian majesty, was the sovereign of the oldest and most powerful dynasty in Europe. His main concern was the Archduchess pretty? And did she have a good bosom? Would she please his awkward, bumbling, stumbling 15-year-old grandson enough to procreate? Maria Antonia, after months of preparation, which included painful teeth straightening and tiresome etiquette lessons, was stripped of everything Austrian, including her pet doggy Mops, on an island in the middle of the Rhine. She arrived in Strasbourg as Marie Antoinette in the spring of 1770 and traveled on toward Versailles to meet her fiancé. In every town, she was cheered, hailed, and greeted by dancing children offering her flowers. Louis XV found her delectable. Unfortunately, his grandson preferred chasing stag instead of his bride. 4 years later, in 1774, when Louis XV died, his grandson, now Louis XVI, was still without issue. Louis XVI had been raised by his tutors to mistrust Austrians, and he remained aloof from his bride. But that was only part of the problem. With all of the education young Louis XVI had received in classics, math, and geography, no one had bothered to instruct him in the act of sexual intercourse between people. They had shown him flowers, birds, and bees, but Louis was unable to translate the allegorical lessons into practical skills. Marie Antoinette, essentially neglected and bored as any teenage girl might be, bought pretty clothing and went to parties. When her husband's ministers, who had begun whispering the word annulment, advised the king that it would be too expensive and would make divorce more difficult to formally crown Marie Antoinette Queen of France, she devised her own tiara, outlandishly high and elaborate hair concoctions designed by Monsieur Léonard. Some were so high that ladders were needed to place finishing touches. Most were fashioned to commemorate special events in French history, sometimes bringing honor to living heroes, and often highlighting current fascinations. The king's two younger brothers, the Comte de Provence and the Comte d'Artois, also married. Their princesses were Italian sisters whom both men found dirty and repulsive. The king's youngest brother, the Comte d'Artois, was a noted rake who had designed a pleasure palace called Bagatelle in the Bois de Boulogne in Paris. Despite complete revulsion for his bride, Artois went ahead and made love to his wife anyway for the good of France. The couple produced two sons. Marie Antoinette, however, remained childless while her husband busied himself with his hunting expeditions and his other favorite hobby, making locks and keys. The sexual connotation was not lost on anybody except the king. In the spring of 1777, after 7 years after Marie Antoinette had become Dauphine of France, Empress Maria Theresa, desperately anxious about the future of Franco-Austrian affairs, sent her eldest son to the rescue. When the future Holy Roman Emperor, Joseph, arrived at Versailles, he had a brotherly talk with the King of France. What Joseph learned made him belly laugh, and he sent a detailed report to his brother Leopold. As the Habsburgs were a rather large group of siblings, about 15 of them on the thrones around Europe, that letter made the rounds, making the now 22-year-old King of France a royal laughingstock. In essence, Joseph had discovered that Louis XVI, master of Versailles and monarch of the oldest continuing dynasty in Europe, knew how to begin the job of making love, but had no idea how to finish it. Joseph remained long enough to be sure that Louis at last really understood what was to be done, and then Joseph returned to Vienna. On August 18th, between 10 and 11:15 in the morning, after the Queen's bath, Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI had sex for the first time. On August 30th, she wrote her mother, "It has already been more than 8 days since my marriage was perfectly consummated. The proof has been repeated yesterday even more completely than the first time." Louis, now fully satisfied with himself, began to wonder, whose fault would it be if he and the Queen were unable to reproduce? His ministers had been urging him to send his wife packing for years. But Louis, unwilling to lay the blame on his wife, now had a new understanding, and he hatched a plan. Subsequent evidence reveals that Louis decided to test his manhood with another woman, one who had proven to be fertile. This young woman was a young chambermaid at the court named Philippine de Lambriquet, whose husband Jacques served on the staff of the Comte de Provence, Louis' younger brother. Philippine and Jacques already had two healthy children. The king allegedly engaged in a liaison with Philippine, who became pregnant. According to court gossip, Louis was the father of that child. He himself was now convinced of his own fertility. Marie Antoinette had known, even before she left the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, that her job was to produce the heir to the throne of France. Once she arrived in France, her mother continuously harped and nagged. The Empress instructed her daughter to be willing and sweet. Maria Theresa gave instructions on the proper diet to ensure pregnancy, and told her daughter to refrain from horseback riding. While at the same time that she incessantly criticized Marie Antoinette for her failure to please her husband, the Empress advised her daughter to maintain an inner state of tranquility. Marie Antoinette would lie to her mother, pretending that she was behaving according to the Empress's wishes. But the Empress knew otherwise through detailed reports on Marie Antoinette's activities sent by the Austrian ambassador, Count Mercy. To retaliate, Maria Theresa regaled her daughter with a list of all of her other children who were having babies, and all of the pride she took in everyone except the Queen of France. Maria Theresa demanded to know when her daughter's monthly periods came, and Marie Antoinette complied. The Empress, mistrustful of her own child, also insisted on receiving this same information from Count Mercy. At last, on April 20th, 1778, Ambassador Mercy wrote to the Empress that everyone at court was whispering about the fact that Marie Antoinette had not had her period at the beginning of the month. In May, the doctors confirmed that the Queen, after 8 years of marriage, was at long last pregnant. A month later, when the Empress badgered her daughter to intervene in political discussions with Louis about relations between Austria and France, Marie Antoinette gleefully dismissed her mother with the response that meddling in politics was not good for her pregnancy. The summer of 1778 was unbearably hot. A rumor had spread among the populace that the American scientist and inventor Benjamin Franklin, living near Paris at the time, had electrified the weather in order to prevent any storms until Marie Antoinette's first child was born. On Friday, July 31, Marie Antoinette felt the baby's first movement. Teasing her husband, she told him that one of his subjects had had the audacity to kick her in the stomach. The king, with tears in his eyes, gave a triumphant shout. That very same day, Philippine de Lambriquet gave birth to a daughter, Marie Philippine. Tongues wagged immediately. Not only did the baby girl closely resemble the king, but the Comte de Provence was to be little Marie Philippine's godfather, an honor usually reserved for the newborns of the highest nobility. In the meantime, preparations were being made for the royal birth. It was customary for witnesses to be present at royal births in most European countries. However, in France, when the queen was to be delivered of a child, the event became a public spectacle. Just after midnight on Saturday, December 19, Marie Antoinette began to feel contractions. A chain of toxin alerted the nation, and by 2 o'clock in the morning, crowds began to arrive at Versailles. It was so congested and hot that when the queen needed air, the king broke one of the windows that had been nailed shut for the winter. At around 11:30 in the morning on December 19, in full view of hundreds of people, the queen gave birth to a healthy, fair-haired, blue-eyed daughter named Marie-Thérèse Charlotte. As the daughter of a king of France, she would be known as a child of France. As the king's firstborn daughter, her formal title would be Madame Royale. The king exuberantly grabbed his infant daughter and carried her in the air, proceeding into a larger antechamber for the baby's baptism. The baby had upstaged her mother, who had fainted, but no one noticed. Near a state of coma, it was at last the queen's own surgeon who realized that the queen had blacked out, and he revived her. When, after the baby's baptism, the king placed his daughter in her mother's arms, the queen believed that she had failed everyone. Addressing her daughter while the little girl was in her arms, Marie Antoinette's first words to Marie Thérèse were, "Poor little girl, you were not what was desired, but you are no less dear to me on that account. A son would have been the property of the state. You shall be mine. You shall have my undivided care. You will share all my happiness, and you will alleviate my sufferings." The king insisted that he was not disappointed and reassured his wife that now that they had figured out what to do, they could do it again, and they would have many more children. Louis was not insincere and had even publicly declared and wagered his mother-in-law that Marie Antoinette would give birth to a girl because the king of Sweden had had a son that year, and Louis believed that no two kings could be born in the same year. Later on, Marie Thérèse herself would ask her father if her birth had been a disappointment. The king, teary-eyed, would recount this entire scenario and assure her that he was absolutely thrilled, never disappointed, and thoroughly smitten with her from the day of her birth. The awkward, shy dauphin, who had grown into a clumsy, hesitating man, had become a deliriously, decisively proud father, and his unabashed giddiness allowed his wife to see him through new eyes. Their joy brought them closer together, and like many new parents, they conspired to create a world of love and happiness for their baby. As always, surrounding the birth of a royal baby, gossip mongers and those in line for the throne tried to cast doubt about the baby's parentage. The empress received the baby's portrait, this very one, and publicly declared her namesake the image of her father. This baby, of course, was no ordinary mortal. And upon her arrival, Marie Thérèse already had a carefully selected staff of nearly 100. Waiting to serve her every need were a head governess, 4 sous governesses, a royal hairdresser, a dentist, although she had no teeth, a cradle rocker, wet nurses, and on and on. There were even servants to serve the servants. The expenses for the baby's household were staggering. Someone calculated that it cost 5,000 livres to serve the princess a bowl of soup. Industries across the country sent their finest wares to honor the little girl. Sumptuous silks, porcelains of great artistry, silver and cabinetry were offered to adorn the nursery of the tiny Madame Royale. Towns around the country celebrated with effusive displays of fireworks. Coins of the realm were minted featuring mother and child. The opera in Paris gave free performances to celebrate the baby's arrival. After all, this tiny girl was the child of a king of France. Since the time of the great Charlemagne, the French kings had been considered God's lieutenants, a symbol of divinity on earth. The king and his family were sacred. They were not allowed to attend funerals, and very few humans on earth were allowed to even touch the person of the king, his queen, and the royal offspring. Among the royal families of Europe, there was immediate discussion about whom this little girl would eventually marry. When the king's cousin, the enormously rich Duke d'Orléans, put forth his own son and was rebuffed, he began on a path of revenge that would fuel the French Revolution. For the time being, King Louis XVI was correct in his optimism. He and Marie Antoinette would indeed have more children. Maria Theresa would not live to see the arrival 2 years later, after the birth of Madame Royale, of, at long last, a dauphin, Louis Joseph. The king and queen of France together had another son, Louis Charles, and another daughter, Sophie, who would sadly die within a year of her birth. When, shortly after Sophie's death, the chambermaid, Philippine de Lambriquet, died, Marie Antoinette adopted Marie Philippine, renamed her Ernestine, after the heroine in a popular novel, and Ernestine became a member of the royal brood, with no expense spared. She was educated alongside the royal children, and the king provided an independent and very large fund for the adopted child. His generosity did not surprise people, as kings had often doled out their largesse when it suited them. What astonished many, however, was the resemblance between Ernestine and Madame Royale. And as they were the same age and were always together, they seemed like twins. As Marie Antoinette had rightly predicted, the Dauphin of France belonged to the state. Louis Joseph was separated from his siblings and, for the most part, from his own mother, as he was being tutored to rule. Her youngest living child, Louis Charles, became her little chou d'amour, her little love cabbage. He was irresistible. Ash blonde shoulder length ringlets framed his angelic face. He had cerulean blue eyes and was considered by many to be the most beautiful and sweet of the royal children. Louis Charles doted on his mother and sister, often bringing them flowers. He could be a bit naughty, was absolutely adorable, and became his elder sister's favorite playmate. Here they are together in front of the Temple of Love. Marie Therese felt both a big sister's responsibility and a mother's love for her youngest brother. They were so close that they even sat in on each other's lessons and spent days together at their mother's beloved private retreats, the Petit Trianon and the Hameau, where the queen had installed a menagerie, the children's own zoo. These now famous sanctuaries of Marie Antoinette's, reputed to be the place of orgies and drug abuse, were really merely private homes where her children, who had been forced into a very public role from infancy, could be children. The queen insisted on no formality. She introduced sleigh rides, children's parties, and the kind of relaxed fun impossible to duplicate under the watchful eye of the snobbish courtiers at Versailles. She wanted her children to have a childhood. Marie Therese was educated and prepared to comport herself with dignity according to the rigid standards of protocol of Versailles that had been established by Louis XIV. She appeared in dresses and wigs that weighed more than she did, was forced to endure ceremonial pomp and circumstance that often lasted hours. And although she performed like the royal princess she was, these events were not fun for a child. Marie Antoinette noted that, understandably, there was a contradiction in her daughter's character as a result. Marie Therese, in private, was sunny and sweet, but again, understandably, could become testy in those uncomfortable ceremonial costumes as throngs of strange grown-ups lined up to see her and pay homage to her person. Marie Antoinette laughingly nicknamed her daughter Mousseline Sérieuse, for she was both light and breezy like muslin and had high transparent coloring, but she could also be quite unpleasant and grumpy. Marie Therese, like many young girls, adored her father unconditionally, but found her mother's supervision annoying. Once, when told that her mother had fallen off a horse but was not injured, Marie Therese responded, stunning a priest, that if her mother had died, she could do whatever she liked. Her feelings toward her mother changed as the storm clouds gathered over the royal family and the Ancien Régime itself. When Marie Antoinette appeared regal and serene at the dreaded May 1789 convocation of the Estates General, Marie Thérèse was in awe of her mother's majestic stoicism. When the Dauphin died just a few short days after this historic event, Marie Thérèse understood that it was her mother who held the suffering family together while remaining in the political fray to ensure the throne of France now for Louis Charles. When the mobs attacked Versailles on October 5, 1789, Marie Antoinette emerged on a balcony and made a deep curtsy to the violent crowd. Stunned by the Queen's courage, the invading marauders lowered their weapons and cheered. Marie Antoinette's solitary appearance, a moment of unparalleled bravery, was admired even by her enemies. Many advised the King and Queen to flee France, but the King refused to go, and Marie Antoinette remained firm. She would not abandon her husband. To Marie Thérèse, that was true nobility. Those who had accused Marie Antoinette of being nothing more than a luxury-loving, silly woman greatly underestimated the power of motherhood. The birth of Marie Thérèse had transformed the pleasure-loving, party-going young teenage queen into a woman, a mother, who would protect her family and set an example for her children. The family was now ensconced in the musty and uninhabitable Tuileries Palace. The King and Queen tried to make their home as normal as they could for their children. The family lived in closer quarters and under surveillance, while the children resumed lessons and the little prince marched about the gardens to the delight of the guards. Marie Thérèse and Ernestine received their first communion together at Easter in 1790, but the King could not attend because of the difficult logistics involved in escorting the royal family around Paris. It was at last, in 1791, when the National Guard refused to allow the family to travel outside the walls of the Tuileries, that the King, Queen, and children attempted their escape. Many have told the story of this ill-fated flight to Varennes, blaming the King's capture on a peasant's recognition of the royal face on a coin. But that story is wildly inaccurate. The King's face on the coins, slimmed down and much more attractive than he was in person, bore little resemblance to His Majesty in real life. In truth, the capture of the royal family was one of those sad, farcical, and frustrating moments of theater. First, the royal family's escape was badly scheduled for the longest day of the year. Second, they traveled in a massive coach that, during protracted daylight, was easily spotted along the road by all the wrong people. Third, their intended saviors, troops led by the Duc de Choiseul, mistimed their appearance. The royal family dressed in sad and embarrassing disguise and traveling under pseudonyms, Marie Thérèse traveled as Sophie, they were forced to return to Paris. Most agree from that moment on, whatever sympathy the King might have enjoyed was now gone. He was completely impotent as a monarch. Other monarchs, outraged by the capture of the royal family, offered to invade France. Louis XVI refused their offer. The Duke of Brunswick ignored the King's statements, believing them to be a cover for his true wishes, and the Duke of Brunswick undertook an invasion, which only made the French citizens even angrier with their king. Marie Thérèse was formed by the lessons she learned from her mother about stoicism, bravery, resignation, charity, and steadfastness. The deaths of Sophie and Louis-Joseph only brought the two surviving children, Marie Thérèse and Louis Charles, if it were possible, even closer, and that relationship also defined her life. And when Louis XVI refused foreign help to kill Frenchmen in order to save himself, Marie-Thérèse learned that her father's Bourbon banner was not just about family honor. It waved for all of the people of France, and it stood for humanity over brutality. As every school child knows, both Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette went to the guillotine. That's a portrait of the family taken from eyewitness accounts of how they all behaved the night before the king was executed, and Marie Thérèse wept so badly that she fainted. Their two children and the king's sister, Madame Elizabeth, were left behind in the foreboding medieval temple prison. According to the queen's instructions, a courtier, Madame de Soucy, had whisked away Ernestine to a safe haven somewhere in hiding. Right before the fall of Robespierre, the angelic, pious Madame Elizabeth was also executed. Now the children were alone to face their jailers. Marie Thérèse could hear her brother's screams as the citizen guards beat the little boy. They poured liquor down his throat and refused the little Dauphin medical treatment. He was so afraid of anyone who came into his room that he stopped speaking. And after a while, covered in sores and weighing barely a feather, he was simply too weak to do so. Marie Thérèse, 14 years old when her parents were murdered, was not even permitted matches to light candles. She, in turn, refused to speak with her jailers. They would ask her if she needed anything, and, as she quickly learned that nothing would be provided, she began to ignore their questions. Rumors began to spread that Marie Thérèse was drugged and raped while she was in jail. As a result, many believed that she had simply lost her mind. For hundreds of years, the French had considered themselves to be the most refined of Europe, the guardians of the most civilized society, and their court the most rarefied. In their treatment of the two royal children, the citizens of France debased themselves and demonstrated the worst of humanity. It was because of maltreatment and torture that at last the darling little boy, whose long eyelashes and blonde ringlets made hearts melt, died in June of 1795. He had just turned 10. Cries of horror were heard around the world, and people began to demand kinder treatment for the only surviving child of the murdered king and queen. Queen Maria Carolina of Naples, the late Marie Antoinette's favorite sister, offered a mother's love. The king of Spain offered to house her in Madrid, but his offer came with territorial strings. In the meantime, Marie Thérèse languished in the temple prison. It was a grueling existence of deprivation. At last, with an eye on her inherited claims to the vast territories of Alsace-Lorraine and Navarre, the Holy Roman Emperor, now her first cousin Franz, began serious negotiations with the new French Directory for the release of Madame Royale. In a letter to the French, the Austrian minister wrote that the emperor wanted his cousin in Vienna, and he was willing to exchange prisoners of war for her release. He also personally requested that Ernestine accompany Marie Thérèse to Vienna. At precisely midnight on her 17th birthday, Marie Thérèse slipped out of the temple prison, accompanied by the French Minister of the Interior, Benezek. She would once again travel under the name Sophie. There could be much danger on this journey. Many were out to kidnap or harm the royal princess. Both the new French Directory and the Austrian governments deliberately supplied the public with misinformation to keep the princess's journey a secret. Nonetheless, the King of Spain, the Comte de Provence, now living in Italy as King Louis XVIII after the death of Louis Charles, and others with varying political agendas, all had spies on the road with the intention of intercepting Marie Thérèse's cortege. Minister Benezek and the lovely blonde-haired young woman, Sophie, ran to a waiting carriage on the adjacent Rue Meslay. As the church bells chimed the hour, she remarked to her companion that she had been in the prison for 3 years, 4 months, and 5 days. For 200 years, there has been speculation that somewhere between the Temple Prison and an arrival in Vienna, Marie-Thérèse of France changed places with Ernestine. Had Marie-Thérèse been drugged and raped in prison, as many had whispered? Did she suffer a nervous breakdown? The French Minister of the Interior made his way to the Rue de Bondy, where two traveling carriages were stationed. In one were Madame de Soucy, charged with looking after Ernestine, a Temple prison guard, and a policeman who would pose as Sophie's father. In the other carriage, according to official reports later distributed, were Madame de Soucy's teenage son, her maid, and a manservant of the late King Louis XVI. The only problem with that scenario was that Madame de Soucy did not have a teenage son. Was the teenage son really Ernestine? Many believe so, and insist it was at this point when Marie-Thérèse and Ernestine exchanged identities. Others believe that the switch occurred later as the two carriages continued to the border town of Huning, where Marie-Thérèse was visited by a young seamstress. Was the young dressmaker a ruse? Was she really Ernestine in disguise? Still others who believe that a switch occurred posit the possibility that the two young women may have switched places even closer to Vienna. As Marie-Thérèse got closer to a forced marriage with her cousin Archduke Karl. Did it happen in the Swiss town when she was turned over to the Austrians, or the German town where she paid a visit to the Elector, a cousin of her late father? None of these people had ever seen her in the flesh. For that matter, she had been in prison for so much of her childhood that few Frenchmen could recognize her either. In order to get to the truth, it was imperative to follow two lives. One woman performed a role on the political stage of Europe, while the other lived quietly in a foreboding and isolated castle in Hildburghausen, Germany. One woman defiant, one woman defeated. Believed to have suffered some kind of trauma, the young blonde woman who arrived in Hildburghausen, Germany, lived under the protection of the German aristocracy, many of whom were Marie Antoinette's closest childhood friends. She became known as the Dark Countess. The Dark Countess lived in her German castle in the land and the time of the Brothers Grimm, under such secrecy that the household servants were instructed to turn their backs when the woman passed by. She was overheard to speak French to her gentleman companion, who referred to her as Her Grace. When the blonde-haired woman went outside, she always wore a dark green veil to cover her face, but the few who were able to see her face swore that she was the daughter of the murdered King of France. Her identity was so carefully protected by the German princesses that they made their own children swear to continue to protect this young woman and keep the secret of her identity beyond even her death. When the Dark Countess died in the 1830s, she was buried before dawn beneath the headstone that read, Sophie. Among her effects were possessions that had belonged to Queen Marie Antoinette. The other blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman arrived in Vienna. Upon her arrival, she was presented with a document that had been prepared for her to sign. This document asserted her hereditary rights to Burgundy, Brittany, Lorraine, Alsace, and Franche-Comté, pivotal to both France and Austria. She would claim these lands, marry the emperor's brother, and Austria, as it always had through marriage, would expand its empire. There was one problem. This Marie Therese refused to sign, and she refused to marry Austrian Archduke Karl, despite the attraction that both would feel for each other. This Marie Therese understood the political ramifications of that marriage. She was also the victim of the constant psychological warfare played on her by her Bourbon uncle, Louis XVIII, who fabricated a story that would long after be asserted by loyal courtiers and biographers to have been true. Louis XVIII told his niece that it was her parents' last wish that she marry her cousin, the Duc d'Angoulême. It had been true that before the birth of Louis-Joseph and Louis-Charles, Marie Antoinette, reminded of how unhappy she had been to leave her home, considered Angoulême as a suitable choice for her daughter. However, once she had the two boys, she set her sights elsewhere. Among the young men she thought might be appropriate for Marie Therese was the young man born in the same year, the future King of Sweden. Other candidates included Habsburg cousins on various thrones of Europe. After the death of Louis XVI and his two sons, Angoulême was once again third in line to the throne of France. Marriage between Angoulême and Marie Therese of France would preserve the throne and French territories for the Bourbons if and when they returned. So this child of France obeyed her king and remained defiant toward the Holy Roman Emperor. Marie Therese wore him down until he at last let her leave Vienna and join her family in Russia some 3 years later when Napoleon was on the march. Marie Therese, this Marie Therese, became the Duchess d'Angoulême, and as Napoleon conquered Europe, she accompanied her husband and uncle from Russia to Warsaw, back to Russia, and to England, where she lived at Hartwell House, and was a great friend of the Prince of Wales, the future George IV. After Napoleon's defeat, the Bourbons were recalled to France. During Napoleon's Hundred Days, when the men in the Bourbon family had quickly fled toward Belgium and Spain, Marie Therese, the Duchess d'Angoulême, remained in Bordeaux. There, she courageously led troops against the Corsican-born former emperor, and Napoleon would call her the only man in the family. After Napoleon's definitive defeat at Waterloo, the Bourbons were once again recalled to France. The Duchess d'Angoulême would serve as the face of the Restoration. She would remember the mistakes of the murdered king and queen and place herself at the feet of the French people, traveling throughout the country, hailed as a saint. Marie Therese also raised her beloved niece and nephew, Louise and Henri, while their own mother enjoyed an active social life and would become estranged from the family. To give the children the tranquil, happy life she had known at Versailles' Petit Trianon and Hameau, Marie Therese purchased Villeneuve-les-Tains, an idyllic country retreat outside of Paris that even had an orangery. It so evoked her fond childhood memories that she assembled a menagerie there for the children, as her mother had at Versailles. In 1830, while Marie Therese was on one of her nationwide tours, her father-in-law betrayed her, taking political action he had promised he would not, and the Bourbons once again lost the throne. Many historians often claim that between the time it took for her father-in-law to sign his abdication until the time her own husband followed suit, she was Queen of France for 20 minutes. Legitimists, however, believe that the King of France ascends the throne as a divine right, and an abdication is therefore meaningless. To true legitimists, Marie Therese only became Queen of France upon her father-in-law's death in 1836, and she remained Queen of France until her own husband's demise in 1844. In 1830, when her father-in-law, in essence, resigned, he believed he was doing so to place his grandson, Henri, on the throne. He had, however, been duped by his cousin, the current Duke d'Orléans, son of the regicide who had sent Louis XVI to the scaffold. Far more politically astute than the men in her family, Marie-Thérèse was not at all surprised to learn that it was Orléans who had caused dissent and a grab for the throne, as his father had before him. She had for years warned her father-in-law and uncle that the Dukes of Orléans had but one motive, to seize the throne of France from their cousins. They had tried over and over again, as one recalls, the Fronde, the rebellions of the aristocracy incited by a Duke d'Orléans that faced Louis XIV, the Orléans Regency during the reign of Louis XV, and of course the one whose treachery had caused the death of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. Marie-Thérèse had heard from courtiers that it was partially due to the fact that because she, Marie-Thérèse, was not slated to marry his son, the current Duke d'Orléans, that he had begun to plant the seeds of rebellion by financing political meetings at his Palais Royal, to finance uprisings, and to secretly publish those nasty libels, the pamphlets, that had fired up the people against her father. When the Bourbons returned to the throne and his son, the current Duke d'Orléans, waged a campaign among the monarchs of Europe to become King of France, Marie-Thérèse advised like father, like son, and when her uncles ignored her, returning to him his family's riches, she once again warned that they were gravely mistaken and that it would have dire consequences. So once again in 1830, the legitimate royal family, the Bourbons, were once again forced into exile. This time, Marie-Thérèse at last openly remarked that she might have been the only capable monarch in the family, commenting that it was a pity that France was still controlled by Salic law. With her beloved niece and nephew always at her side, Marie-Thérèse returned to England and also lived briefly at Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh until her mother's family offered sanctuary on the continent. Grateful to her British friends, she felt, however, more comfortable in a Catholic country, so she accepted Habsburg hospitality, moving from Prague to Vienna to Carlsbad to Italy until her final days were spent outside Vienna at her home, Froesdorf. Wherever she went and wherever she resided, she would carry the blood-stained shirt of King Louis XVI with her. In 1871, when Henri was offered the throne, he issued the now-famous Chambord Manifesto, insisting on the abolishment of the tricolored flag of the Revolution, stating publicly that this condition was an homage to his beloved aunt, Marie-Thérèse of France. When his demand was not met, Henri refused the crown, choosing instead to live in quiet exile, making Marie-Thérèse the unwitting mother of modern-day Republican France. All through her life, wherever she went, wherever she lived, young men would demand to see Marie-Thérèse, all claiming to be her brother. Tugging at her heartstrings, they would all have the same story. They had been whisked away from the temple prison, and a dying boy had been substituted in the jail cell. Some of these claimants had such personal details that even former servants of the king believed their stories. Marie-Thérèse refused to meet with any of them. Those who believe in the switch conspiracy point to this as proof that an imposter would be afraid to have her charade exposed. Most historians claim that she was absolutely convinced that her brother had died in the prison and would not entertain meeting the posers. In papers that I found right here in New York, In the New York Historical Society Gallatin Collection, James Gallatin, son of the American ambassador to France, wrote in his own diary that the Duchess d'Angoulême privately asked him to search for her brother when he returned home to the United States, proving that she was never completely convinced that Louis Charles had died. Imagine the pain she endured throughout her life. It was only in the year 2000, with the advent of DNA testing, that scientists were able to prove that little Louis Charles had indeed died in the Temple prison. But before that date, there had never been proof positive. That heart was laid to rest in the Royal Crypt in Saint-Denis, and there's the little monument. It was time to find the answer to the other mystery. What happened to the only surviving child of Marie Antoinette? After all, there are people in Europe who, to this day, claim to be her descendants through the story that she was either raped or fell in love with a prison guard and was not allowed to go to Vienna for that reason. Still today, each September, a large group of eminent European scientists, doctors, and historians convene in Germany to discuss this controversy. There have been television shows, dramas, and in 2007, just this past year, a nine-month jubilee to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the arrival of the Dark Countess in the German town of Hildburghausen. It was celebrated with great fanfare and significance. Too many questions remained unanswered. Why was Madame de Soucy, charged with looking after Ernestine, able to blackmail the Duchesse d'Angoulême for so many years? She received great amounts of money. Why would the Duchesse d'Angoulême never meet with any of the young men claiming to be her brother? How did some of Marie Antoinette's possessions end up in the estate of the woman known as the Dark Countess? I had to know the answer to these disturbing questions. Even DNA testing would be complicated, as both Ernestine and Marie Therese were reputed to be the daughters of Louis XVI. It took me 4 years of research, which included the taxing task of visiting some of Europe's most splendid palaces, comparing handwriting samples and matrilineal DNA testing performed by the very same doctors in Belgium involved with the Dauphin's heart. And I can assure you here today that we now know the truth about the fate of the only child to survive the Reign of Terror, definitively descended from both King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette of France. Thank you. I know the first question. Which one was she? There you go. And any other questions?